day I faced a barren waste without the taste of water. Cool water. Old Dan and I, with throats burned dry and souls that cry for water.
Water.
Cool
water.
Clear.
Welcome to another edition of Raising Sand Radio. I'm your host, Susan Gallimore, with the Sons of Pioneers and their classic piece, Cool Water. In the villages of Karawat Bani Zaid, Kfar Ain, Bin Rama, Indir Ghassani, and Nabisala, the taps have been running dry. No water for drinking, for washing, for livestock, or agriculture. Many Palestinians in this area have not had water from their taps since March 15th. The villages, situated northwest of Ramallah, are inhabited by about 15,000 people who, at the height of the scorching summer season, receive a rationed amount of water amounting to 48 liters a day per person, less than the average consumed by Palestinians, which is 66 liters a day per person, and one-fifth of the average provided to the Jewish settlements in the occupied territories and in Israel, which is at 235 liters a day. In the winter, the water ration for the villages stood at 60 to 70 cubic meters per hour, and now at the height of summer, it has been cut down to only 30 cubic meters per hour. In the past, the villages had drawn their water from Abud Spring, which amply supplied all of their domestic herding and farming needs. Mekorot, Israel National Water Company, has created its own infrastructure at the spring and only allows a small portion of its water to arrive in the villages. Now there is no water for farming, livestock is dwindling, the Palestinians themselves have a bare minimum for their own use, while their settler neighbors behind the fences and walls enjoy a bountiful supply. Since the beginning of the occupation in 1967, Israel has taken control over most water sources in the West Bank and uses it mostly for Israeli clients, including the settlers. The mountain aquifer, with its yearly yield of 600 million cubic meters, is considered a joint Palestinian-Israeli reservoir, of which Israel is permitted to use, but certainly not in its present proportions, which is about 80% of the water taken for Israeli consumption, while 2.5 million Palestinians living in the West Bank receive the remaining 20%, or according to some Palestinian sources, the split is more like 84-16%. In the Jordan Valley, Israel draws 32 million cubic meters of water a year, primarily for exported agricultural products, while total Palestinian domestic industrial and agricultural consumption for the whole West Bank is limited to 190 million cubic meters, and many Palestinian communities in the Jordan Valley are made to go without. Furthermore, 227,500 people living in 220 West Bank villages are not even connected to the water supply grid. Another 190,000 enjoy only a partial supply of running water. A number of Israeli and Palestinian progressive organizations are highlighting these inequalities. Last week, there were at least three demonstrations in the Tel Aviv area focusing on this water issue. Today, it's my great pleasure to welcome Susan Kopelman, who joined us via Skype earlier this week from Ramallah in the West Bank. Susan works with LifeSource, a Palestinian-led collective that focuses specifically on the issues associated with water in Israel and Palestine. LifeSource's overarching goal is building a popular movement for water sustainability and water sovereignty. The collective's main office is in Nablus, and they have another satellite office in Gaza. I started off by asking Susan to draw a big picture affecting the water in Israel and the West Bank.
There are a number of issues. The main issue has to do with control over water resources, and that includes also the ability to develop water resources. So with the beginning of the occupation, Israel took control over all of Palestinian water resources with a military order. And later military orders required that Palestinians get permission to drill, that they get permission even to deepen existing wells if they dried up from deep Israeli wells, which is something that continues to happen today. Basically, the whole water sector became under control of the Israeli military commander. Now, actually, Oslo set up a joint water council, and Oslo made a number of it came up with certain quantities for the Palestinians and certain quantities for the Israelis, and it was in fact the first time that Palestinian water rights were recognized. However, what we've found is that the Joint Water Council, with equal number of Palestinians and Israelis, meant to determine water development in the West Bank, has not at all functioned as a joint institution. The World Bank recently, in April, just published a report in which they found that due to fundamental asymmetries of power, that this council is not functioning jointly. And so the result of this is that there has actually been a decline in the amount of water yielded from Palestinian-controlled sources since Oslo. Now, the Joint Water Council was supposed to improve development for Palestinians or to facilitate development, and we find that sources in Palestinian control are yielding 25 million cubic meters less now than they were before Oslo. At the same time, there is a number of development projects that have taken place in the settlements that have not been brought before the Joint Water Council. And all of this is to say that Palestinians are becoming increasingly dependent on purchasing water from Israel. Now, as part of the Oslo Accord, Israel was obligated to sell Palestinians a certain amount of water. And they are not only selling the amount they were supposed to, but they're selling even more. So Israel likes to look at the amount that Palestinians have access to or consuming, but this issue is Palestinians don't have control over when they get this water from Israel. So the national water carrier, it's called Mekarot, and Mekarot chooses when it gives the water to Palestinians. Now, in the summer, the needs are much greater. In the summer, across the board, Palestinians, Israelis are consumed more. And in fact, actually, if we look at Mekarot supply to Palestine in the summer months, it is increased. But in some communities, particularly in Area C, and also in Karawit bin Yazid, which is the village where we had the demonstration today, we see a sharp decrease. So actually now, the village of Karawat bin Yazid, they're only receiving half as much water as they did 2 years ago, and one-third of the amount that they received in the wintertime.
Susan, what is the criteria that Mekarot uses to decide when they will or will not deliver water?
There isn't a formal criteria, but the practical criteria that we observe is that the settlements get as much water as they need, and then what is left over is sold to the Palestinians. So this is happening in a regional basis. There are different well systems in different areas. So in the area where Karawat bin Yazid is, there are two Israeli wells, or Israeli-controlled wells, in the West Bank, nearby to these villages, that are providing water to those nearby settlements and to some of the Palestinian villages. So what it seems is that Israel has decided that, you know, by maintaining the supply to the settlements, that they're, you know, then they're dividing the leftover water between the Palestinian communities, and this community is, you know, experiencing a sharp decrease in their supply.
I want to just mention that one of the interviews that I did recently with a Palestinian family, the family had been completely cut off with a fence around their entire living area. They'd had greenhouses and chickens and everything. And her husband actually now has gone from being a farmer, you know, a man that could afford to feed his family and make a living, to now selling water. He drives a water truck around. Is this something common?
Yeah, I don't know too many families that are completely surrounded on four sides by the wall.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, and actually what I remember from his story is that he had a very successful greenhouse, and a foreign investor actually wanted to buy the greenhouse for $200,000, and he thought it was worth more, and this greenhouse was completely demolished when they built the wall.
Right, yeah.
I mean, I think it's very common for people to become taxi drivers or service drivers. I mean, there's a famous pizza shop in Ramallah, Osama's Pizza, and this man is a technician and learned how to construct teeth in New York. and when he was paying the bills was also learning how to make pizza. People are definitely changing careers, professions. A lot of people are losing their land. And if they still have access to land, they don't have enough access to water to farm it.
In the day-to-day, this means that people turn on the faucet in their house and nothing comes out?
Yes, in the village where we were today, 60% of the families haven't had any water coming from their tap since March 15th.
What do they do?
So what they have to rely on water that's delivered by a tanker. But because of the transportation costs, and also in some areas, and in this area, it does seem that there is a sort of middleman taking more profit than maybe... is capitalizing on the captive markets, let's say, it's very expensive and the quality isn't known. There isn't enough water in the West Bank for Palestinians, period. So some of the water tankers are being filled up at filling points. They're actually being filled up at filling points that are controlled by Mekarot, and they're paying Mekarot for the water. And then the cost of gas and transportation and sitting at the checkpoints or going around the roadblocks is factored in to the cost. And this community is paying 40 shekels per cubic meter of water, whereas water that comes from the tap is only 4 shekels per cubic meter. 10 times as much. And then actually, the two nearby filling points that were operated by Mekarot, where actually the municipality would take the water and they would deliver the water at cost, these filling points have actually been closed in order to not cut off the supply of the industrial settlements right there. And so now there isn't any water that is where the municipality is able to fill up. And so there's different, so the places where the local people are filling up water tankers and then selling to their neighbors, sometimes there are legal connections from the network, and those connections are safe, but it affects actually how much water or the amount, it affects the meters, and it, you know, some communities or the Palestinian Water Authority or the West Bank Water Department end up, you know, not getting the cost of that water recovered. But then what's most dangerous is when water is filled up from polluted springs or from abandoned cisterns. And so then there's high risk of waterborne diseases.
Mm. Talk a little bit about the state of the water there. Is it a lot of it comes from the wells, but is it contaminated or is it fresh or is it pure? What is the quality of the water like that is sold?
The quality of water in the West Bank is very good, and this is why Israel wants to control it. By contrast, the quality of water in Gaza is awful. Between 5 and 10% of it only meets World Health Organization standards for drinkable water. But in the West Bank, there is good, pure water. There is risk of contamination from sewage. Only 10% of water in the West Bank is treated. There has one of the areas where we've seen the Joint Water Council totally failing the Palestinians is in permission to construct wastewater treatment facilities. Now, Israel actually points to Palestinians and says that they're in violation of Oslo by not treating their water, when there's, you know, case after case of where either the Joint Water Council or the civil administration, which is basically the Israeli military force in the West Bank, is preventing these treatment facilities from being built. So where there's, you know, only 10% of the Palestinian sewage is treated, and actually 0% of the sewage from the settlements is treated. And now the settlements are more likely to have industrial zones. They're also very likely to have industry that has been ruled illegal in Israel, but is operating without any sort of oversight in the West Bank. So there's a number of villages. There's village of Azmut, which is downhill from Alon Moray settlement near Nablus, where car battery manufacturing chemicals and leather tanning chemicals are just being released in a stream untreated towards the village. Also from Ariel settlement and Barkan settlement, the sewage is being released and it's going right through Palestinian communities. It's going right near their wells and their springs. A third example I'll give you is also in the village of Azmut, there is an unlined industrial landfill with industrial waste from the settlements nearby that is being dumped just 200 meters away from a well that is serving five communities. And actually, one of those communities who's being served from that well, they have six wells on their land that have all been stolen by the wall. This is the community of Jayus. Now, actually, we've done a lot of work in Jayus, and we have a short film, We the Women of Jayus, that you can see on our website, that talks about this community. Their main concern actually wasn't access to water, but quality of water. They know there's an industrial landfill that's unlined, it's not legal, 200 meters from the water source they are forced to use now because all of their clean wells are on the other side of the wall. And they actually don't drink the water that comes from the system. They use it just for cleaning. And for drinking, they rely on water that they harvest from the rain when there's enough of it. Now, actually, we know from the Palestinian Water Authority, from the Palestinian Hydrology Group, and from the local municipality that actually, as of now, this industrial landfill is not yet affecting the quality of water. But we know from the villagers that if they drink from this water, they get sick, if they drink without boiling it. So actually, we did a study with them, and what we found was the source of contamination was actually sewage from the village. There isn't a sewage network. Most of the villages don't have a sewage network. And so they have to empty their sewage basically into cesspits near their homes. And these cesspits often overflow, and then the networks are very old. They haven't, been rehabilitated in a long time, and there's cracks. And so then the sewage infiltrates the network. Maybe there's chlorine, some amount of chlorine in the system, but still maybe, some amounts of the contamination enter the roof tank, and then they kind of breed there. After 3 hours, the chlorine is no longer effective. The, fecal bacteria, the fecal coliform, is growing in their roof tanks, and then this is what comes out of their taps. Mm. So working with them, actually, it was a really inspiring situation. So that, the next step is, okay, so let's come up with a campaign to clean the roof tanks. And maybe, we link this, somehow to the, industrial landfill and the six wells behind the wall. And, okay, so they're doing what they can to improve their water supply. And then, what can we do that they have more control and more access to water? And actually, as soon as they learned this information, as soon as they realized, the situation, they asked us how to clean the roof tanks and, what to do. And before we can even talk to them and help them to organize, they had actually, with just really short period of time, had ensured that all of the roof tanks in the village were cleaned. Mm. And so they're also now, we're working with them on a campaign to clean up this landfill.
You're listening to Raising Sand Radio on KZSU Stanford, FM 90.1. I'm your host, Susan Gallimore, talking today about water. We're speaking with Susan Kopelman via Skype from Ramallah. How easy is it to get this information out? And when it does get out, are the Israelis that are interested in working more closely around these issues, since water affects everybody?
Yes, yes. Well, what we see is organizations like Friends of the Earth Middle East, they're interested in the sewage issue, but they really seem to be interested in the sewage, what happens when it crosses the green line into Israel. And that's sort of where they focus, where maybe we focus on the sewage when it's leaving the settlements and going through that small village and going, headed directly towards Nablus, when it could be, networked and, released the other way. I was really surprised. Friends of the Earth Middle East, maybe they have a slightly different focus, and they're focused on actually good water neighbors and, Palestinian communities and Israeli communities that are located really close on either side of the line, which is, a different perspective, than we take, where, we are really focused on ending the occupation, on, you know, removing the settlements. And yes, there's a lot of, you know, information we're producing, and we work together with Israeli groups to get that information out. And we want to support Israeli groups to do the organizing in their society, rather than talking about being good neighbors when there's a 60-year occupation. So we have slightly different perspectives, but generally I think they're a very good organization. But I was really shocked when the World Bank report was released, and the World Bank report actually did go through the, a number of examples of sewage treatment facilities that Israel has blocked from being implemented. And the most egregious example actually is outside of Hebron. It was the most expensive project that had received funding. It was a very good project. And then Israel, the Joint Water Council, said that in order for this project to get permission, that the quality of the effluent needed to be 10-10 standards, or the highest standards. Now, there's actually only one treatment facility in all of Israel that meets these standards, and many treatment facilities in Europe don't even meet these standards. So, you know, just to impose this type of standard for Palestinians when there's only one functioning wastewater treatment facility in all of the West Bank in the Ramallah El Bira area, to basically obstruct the sewage from Hebron from being treated, is horrendous. And there's all of these examples. There's another example in Salfit of a project that received approval from the Joint Water Council in 1996, right after Oslo. It took 2 years to tender the project, to buy the land from the local Palestinians, you know, where they wanted to build it. And then the month they started, the civil administration shut them down. So there's all of these examples.
So what was the basis upon which they said they were shutting them down?
They said that they didn't have permission in that area, that this area was now a closed military zone, and that if the people didn't leave, they'd be arrested and their, you know, equipment would be impounded.
Hmm.
Simple as that. The civil administration is able to declare any area a closed military zone whenever they like. Sad fact of the occupation.
Hmm. Let me remind our listeners that we're talking to Susan Kopelman in Ramallah, and today our topic is water, in particularly in the West Bank and Gaza. And Susan, we often see photographs here of you'll see a photograph of a very nice looking settlement with a very large swimming pool, and then you'll see in contrast within the same frame of that photograph a Palestinian village that is just the opposite, very dry looking. And can you comment on that?
Yes, it seems that all of the swimming pools that are owned by Palestinians are inside of the cities. You know, Palestinians like to swim too. But yes, what you're commenting on is this huge inequality between the settlements and the neighboring villages. Actually, I can't remember off the top of my head, but I would like to refer you to a report that B'Tselem released. I believe it was the report they released on World Water Day, which would have been March 20th, where they're commenting specifically on the consumption within certain settlements and then the consumption in the villages nearby.
And
now, there's certain... Yeah.
I just wanted to be sure that our listeners caught the name there. B'Tselem is an Israeli-based human rights organization. And they have, I think their website is betselem.org.
Yeah, I
so
think that's correct.
Okay, go ahead. Sorry to interrupt you. I just want to be sure that people can find this information themselves when they
sure.
need to.
Yeah, so, you know, we see huge inequality in Palestinian water, in water consumption between Palestinians compared to Israelis. And within Palestinian society. Now, there are a number of reasons. First of all, just to say that it is not known exactly how much water is actually consumed in the settlements. Israel does not make this information public. Now, another thing that the Joint Water Council was supposed to make all information sharing between Palestinians and Israelis transparent, but they will not reveal how much they're abstracting from Israeli wells that they have inside of the West Bank, or how much is being consumed by the Israeli settlements. And the other thing we don't know exactly is the cost. There are some misconceptions that, you know, Israelis are paying less than Palestinians, that, you know, the same goes for the settlements. Now, to say from all the information we have, it does seem that consumption in the settlements on a domestic basis is similar to Israeli consumption inside of Israel. Now, the Israeli consumption is much higher than Palestinian consumption. Also, Palestinian consumption in Area A, which is the part of the West Bank that is supposed to be under Palestinian civil and military control, but just sort of side note is that Palestinians don't have military control over any parts of the West Bank, and it's really common for Israeli jeeps to have military incursions into Area A on a weekly, if not daily, basis in some areas. Side note, then there's also Area B, which is Palestinian civil control and Israeli military control, and then Area C, which is Israeli civil control and Israeli military control. Now, this is the area for the where Israel wants to build its settlements or is building the settlements. It's area for settlement expansion, and then it's also area just kind of designated as for security purposes, for military purposes. Now, this classification system was set up under Oslo, but Area C was only supposed to be in Israeli civil and military control for a period of 18 months. But after this, Israel issued a military order, and what we see, the policies, is that Israel has basically annexed the 61% of the West Bank, and they're obstructing all Palestinian development in this area and really trying to make it difficult for Palestinians to live. So we see Mekarot supply to Palestinian villages in Area C is, you know, much more severe and, you know, sharply reduced, if not completely cut off, during the summer months compared to Palestinians in Area A. So we see a number of policies by, you know, controlling development and controlling water supply. We see the Palestinians being pushed more and more to these small sort of population centers, these ghettos, basically, these cantons within the West Bank.
Susan Kopelman, talk about the event, the demonstration that was held in front of the Israeli Water Authority. You referred to it a couple of times.
There have been three events this week, and the event I was referring to is actually a different event, which was an event that happened today, Friday the 7th.
So a number of events.
This I can tell you, I was at the event yesterday, and I can tell you about both of these events.
Go ahead.
Yesterday's event outside of the Israeli Water Authority was basically a very simple event where the Israelis that believe that Israeli control over Palestinian water, and specifically the way in which Israel is limiting water supply to many Palestinian communities in the West Bank, that this is not just and that this needs to change. And they wanted to send a message to the Israeli Water Authority and to the people passing by. They were holding banners that were printed in three different languages, in Arabic, Hebrew, and English, basically calling on Israel to end the water siege on Palestine. And they wanted this event that happened yesterday outside of the Israeli Water Authority was specifically meant to be linked to a water convoy of basically many people beginning in Tel Aviv, people beginning in Jerusalem and beginning in Ramallah, and all meeting up at a spot with three water tankers to deliver water to this one community that is experiencing severe cuts in their water supply, and to send a message that this needs to end, and to, you know, as a small token of the, you know, reparations for the cuts that these communities have been experiencing, to bring some water that's free, that does not cost 40 shekels per cubic meter. So it was important to the Israeli activists that were involved that this not be seen as a nice gesture from the Israelis and, oh, look at the good Israelis who are bringing water to the poor Palestinians, but they wanted to make it very clear that this has to do with Israeli policy, with the policies of their government, and so they wanted to hold these events together.
And Susan, is there a lot of controversy within Israel about the water situation going with the Palestinians, or people tend to agree that there's some injustice going on here?
The Israeli Water Authority and the Israeli administration are very good at PR, and they are very good about how they respond to accusations of injustice in terms of water supply in such a way that is really convincing. And even as someone who's been living in the West Bank and traveling between the West Bank and Gaza for the past 3 years, I have to step back and I have to look at their numbers and break it down and see how they're spinning the numbers. They almost get me sometimes. They're really convincing. And so really people don't know the situation. People they will focus on, what's really common, they will focus on macro supply to the West Bank, and they will say, in fact, we are supplying twice as much as we're supposed to under Oslo, which is true.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact is that because Palestinian development has been obstructed, that Palestinians are increasingly dependent on purchasing from Mekarot, and that even with this additional Mekarot supply, because there are not new wells, that Palestinians are in control of, there is not enough water for the Palestinians. And the fact that Mekarot is charging Palestinians for more water and selling more water to the Palestinians, this isn't the whole picture. You also have to look at the obstruction of development. And then you also have to look at when this water is supplied. So Mekarot issued a statement that actually this village, Karawetz Bin Yazid, or actually I should say to be correct, Bin Yazid municipality, which includes Karawetz Bin Yazid and four other villages, that this municipality is receiving more water this year than last year. Now, if you look at on an annual basis, this is true. But then actually, if you go through all of the bills from Mekarot that are coming through the West Bank Water Department to the municipality, and you look at the quantities that they're being billed for each month now since 2006 to now, you actually see that, this past winter, Mekarot doubled the water supply to this village when they didn't need it, and then now their water supply is, in fact, half or less than half of what it was 2 years ago.
Mm.
They're really tricky. They pay really close attention to detail, and they're able to issue these statements, that are true. And then the West Bank Water Department says, yes, this is true. And the Palestinian Water Authority says, yes, this is true. But nobody actually goes through the bills. And we just did this, trying to make sense because we trust the villagers, we trust the people of the village that their water supply is a fraction of what it was in the winter. And sure enough, this is true.
Mm.
And it's also just a fraction that was 2 years ago. So we see the situation is getting worse and worse as the settlements are expanding. And, as Israel is basically trying to force people, from their villages into the cities and keep them locked in there and expand, throughout this area.
Susan Koppelman, it's been great to talk with you. And I want to refer our listeners to the website, lifesource.ps. They can find the reports, some of the reports that you mentioned there. Is there anything else you'd like to add? I know there's going to be a convoy going out to the Bedouin. I think it's in Beersheba, in the Negev real soon.
Yeah, that's on Friday.
Okay.
Yeah, two other things I would like to say. One is that one of the things that LifeSource is doing in order to get the information out globally is we are producing a number of short films. So we have a short film on the Gaza situation after the war and the ongoing siege, which is preventing materials for water and sanitation development from getting into Gaza. That is actually going to be at the Toronto Film Festival in September. And we have a number of films that we're releasing at the end of this month and the beginning of next month. And those will be available on YouTube. So to stay tuned for that. And then the other thing is, you listening to the situation, what can you do? We at LifeSource are launching a campaign that's looking specifically, if you're focusing on the water situation and water justice, and specific campaigns that are connected to the water situation. So this includes a boycott of the Israeli national water company, Mekarot, which actually is working on developing a relationship with Los Angeles municipality where there's a contract in the works there. And there's also a contract in Manitoba, Canada. Mekarot has more than 40 wells inside of the West Bank. And as you have heard, they are, you know, obstructing Palestinian water supply and reducing Palestinian water supply and, you know, profiting on the situation. Other companies that are profiting on the situation are Israeli water bottling companies like Mer Eden or Eden Springs, which is very big in Europe, and the agricultural company Carmel Agrexco, or Carmel, which is selling produce across Europe. They're actually abstracting, it seems, unofficially, the estimate is 60 million cubic meters from the Jordan Valley, which is all Area C, and these communities are experiencing really difficult times. They're unable to work their own land, and actually, you know, the economic situation and the lack of water situation are basically forcing them to work on the settlements that are colonizing their land, that are using obscene amounts of water for agriculture, for export. So I encourage you to watch these films, to share them with your community, and to learn more about the situation, and to learn more about what you can do to end this unjust system.
There was Susan Kopelman with the Nablus-based collective LifeSource. Go to their website, lifesource.ps, to read the reports that Susan referenced and to learn more about the organization. lifesource.ps.
And can you see that big green tree where the water's running free and it's waiting there for me and you?
The shadows sway and seem to say, tonight we'll pray for water.
Cool water.
And way up there he'll hear our prayer and show us where there's water.
Water.
Cool
water.
Clear
water.
Water.
We'll spend the rest of the hour with Israeli Ron Yaron of Physicians for Human Rights. Ron Yaron's presentation was part of a weekly teleconference conducted by the Palo Alto, California-based nonprofit, the Rebuilding Alliance. This nonprofit rebuilds homes in war-torn areas and makes them safe. Each week, this teleconference invites one Israeli and one Palestinian to present their perspectives on the region. You can email contact@rebuildingalliance.org if you want more information on the weekly teleconference. Today's presentation by Israeli Ron Yaron of Physicians for Human Rights is introduced by Rebuilding Alliance Executive Director Donna Baranski-Walker. The audio quality is not perfect, but I believe the information is important enough that we can bear with the audio quality and pay attention to the content of Yaron's presentation. Unfortunately, the quality of the audio from our Palestinian presenter, who spoke from the Jordan Valley, was just not good enough to broadcast this week. And this is a reflection, I think, of one of the difficulties of life in the region.
Joining us from Physicians for Human Rights Israel is Ron Yaron. Ron is the director now of the group in Physicians for Human Rights that focuses on the occupied Palestinian territories, both Gaza and the West Bank, probably parts of East Jerusalem as well. He's been part of Physicians for Human Rights for 3 years. So he began in 2006. He'd been involved there as first a caseworker, handling individual medical cases, and especially working to help people get permits so that they could receive care or so go to Israel for care, or also to work in Israel if necessary. And now he's the director for all of the territories. When I asked him how he would like me to introduce him, he said that it had been his dream in his studies. His first degree is in political science, and his second is in Arabic studies. So his dream was to be able to combine both Arabic skills, speaking skills, with political skills, and really focus on issues that could bring about human rights. This has been an ideal place for him at Physicians for Human Rights. You'll hear a little bit more about the organization, and you'll note that Ron is not a doctor, but that they use their volunteer network of physicians, and now well over 1,000, provide the services, and then Physicians for Human Rights works on the very important details of getting people across and being able to provide the in-depth reports that can bridge some of the gaps in understanding between among Israelis, among the international community, helping people see really what occupation means from this medical perspective. So with that, I'd like to welcome Ron Yaron. Please, Ron, go ahead.
Hello, thank you very much for inviting me to this phone conference. Well, I said a few words about Physician for Human Rights as it was introduced in the beginning. Physician for Human Rights Israel was established 21 years ago, and this organization is mainly focused on the right to health and its achievements among several sectors within Israel and in the occupied Palestinian territories. And we are speaking mainly about sectors who we believe that Israel bear responsibility for their right to health, for achieving their right to health, and Israel is the one to hold accountability for that issue. Personally, I work in the Occupied Palestinian Territories Department, and we are dealing with access of patients to health care unavailable in the occupied territories, as this is one of the most problematic things that the Palestinians are facing due to the ongoing occupation both of the West Bank and Gaza, and the total total dependency upon external services in terms of medical services. So I will try to speak briefly about the current situation both in Gaza and in the West Bank from the medical perspective, and then to go more in depth to the situation in the West Bank, and especially in Area C, as we see it from our work, from our perspective. I can say that our information that the Physician for Human Rights provides is based on based on individual cases that we receive. We receive an average of 120 to 150 individual cases from patients and medical personnel who are unable to exit the occupied territories due to the security prohibition or due to the security restriction imposed by the Israeli government and the Israeli army. And based on these cases, we can identify patterns that are actually happening on the ground. And of course, the information is also based on ongoing contacts that we are having with the Palestinian medical community and Palestinian NGOs from the occupied territories who cooperate with us and we work together on joint activities and issues. So this is for the introduction, and I think I shall just begin with a short briefing on the situation in terms of health in the occupied territories. Well, in general, the West Bank and Gaza healthcare system is actually in a situation of fragmentation and is totally incoherent. I can say that one particular difficulty is that the Palestinian Authority has limited control over the key determinants of health, such as land, water, the environment, infrastructure, and maybe the most important thing is on human movement. I think between the main provider of healthcare, restriction of movement imposed by the multiple checkpoints, barriers, and the Israeli policy to move, and the separation barrier prevents access of for patients and medical staff. I think I can just comment that only in July 2007 alone, there were 40 recorded cases of ambulances being denied access to patients in the West Bank, and in this specific month, half of the cases were denied access in Area C. A survey at the end of 2003 found that the number of people needing 1 hour or more to reach an appropriate health facility has increased by 10 times in 3 years. So just to present the situation that is ongoing until today, I think with regard to Gaza, I can say that the main problem today is that the healthcare system in Gaza is unable to provide specific health medical services to its population of the strip. I can just very briefly say that there is no radiation therapy, radiation therapy for cancer due to the Israeli restriction. Israel prevents the entry of radioactive materials for security grounds because Israel claims that there is, it can be used as you know, it can be used in order to build a nuclear bomb. So there is no radiotherapy treatment at all in Gaza. Open heart surgeries, ophthalmology treatments are also not available. So in these specific fields, patients are referred out by the Ministry of Health in Gaza to help to medical treatment outside. The problem is that Rafah crossing, the only way out to Egypt, is almost completely closed by the Egyptians as a result of the pressure that Israel and the U.S. put on the Egyptians not to open the gate until the release of the Israeli soldier, Gilad Shalit. So the only way out for patients today to receive health care unavailable in Gaza is by exiting the north checkpoint of the strip, which is Erez crossing, which is completely closed, completely controlled by the Israelis. So all the patients which need to be to receive treatment are need to undergo all the process of the permit systems. And I can say that especially after the Hamas taking control over Gaza in June 2007, this mission of exiting Erez crossing in order to receive treatment, medical treatment, becomes more and more difficult for these patients. And in terms of numbers, I can say that if before June 2007, nearly 90% of the patients who applied for exit permits were actually approved and were able to exit, this number sharply decreased after June 2007, after the Hamas taking control over Gaza. And today, and gradually decreased, and we are speaking today about only 60% of these patients that can actually exit, which means that 40% remain in Gaza without health care. And the average of patients that are referred from Gaza on a monthly basis is around 750. So a short calculation shows that around 350 patients remain in Gaza every month without health care. In addition to that, I can comment on that is being established by the Israelis at every crossing, the gate out that connect Gaza with the Israeli hospitals with Israel. Israel has imposed a policy of interrogations of patients at Erez crossings, and I'm not sure if you're familiar with this phenomena, but since June 2007, nearly 20% of the patients from Gaza are called for interrogations at Erez crossing. They are called to come for interrogation that are undertaken by the Israeli secret police. As a precondition for the exit, and according to dozens of testimonies that Physicians for Human Rights has collected, these patients are oftenly demanded to provide information or to become collaborators on a regular basis as a condition for the exit. Mm-hmm. So here you can see another policy of extortion and coercion of patients. And unfortunately, the general atmosphere now, it's all part of the all con. We should look at the the health aspects on the general context of the siege of Gaza, how Israel has been trying to put pressure on the Hamas government by pressuring the civilians. I mean, it is very simple. I mean, nothing really changed. The patient population remained the same. It's the policy that really has changed. I think this is for Gaza, and very briefly about the situation in the West Bank. In general, the situation in the West Bank remains as it is for nearly 41 years of occupation. This is what is so sad. The healthcare system in the West Bank suffering from an ongoing situation of de-development. No one argue about the presence of the Israeli occupation in as a result of that, the healthcare system in Palestine is totally dependent upon the Israeli one, again, because there is lack of specific medical fields in the West Bank due to the Israeli security reasons and security policy. Israel for years has prevented doctors from exiting the West Bank, from entering Israel for receiving trainings. So in a way, you can see how Israel holds sticks from both sides. On the one hand, there is a policy of system of permits also in the West Bank, where patients who need to receive care unavailable need to ask for permit in order to enter. And on the other hand, Israel prevents the exit of physicians in order to receive trainings and in order to develop the system itself. And I'm an Israeli, and for me, I think I always try to emphasize that it should be Israel's best interest to let the Palestinian healthcare system develop itself in order to reduce actually the dependency of the Palestinians on Israel. And I think this is the only way how the Palestinian society can develop itself and build their own society in a way that will enable them to live in a proper way. Another aspect that we are dealing with is East Jerusalem, the occupied East Jerusalem that was annexed by Israel. There are a group of 5 governmental hospitals in East Jerusalem. All of them are Palestinians and are under the supervision of the Ministry of Health in Ramallah. And despite that fact, medical personnel are not allowed to exit freely from the West Bank to East Jerusalem. They need permits. Israel imposed severe restrictions of movement on the medical personnel and on patients who need to exit to reach the hospitals. I can just give you a short example of what we are dealing with. The civil administration, which is the Israeli body who is responsible for the civil life of the Palestinians in the West Bank, work with quotas. I mean, the civil administration limits the number of the Palestinian workers who are allowed to exit from the West Bank in order to work in their own hospitals in East. So, and these numbers are not based on the hospital's needs. It is based on security of the Israeli state. So in a way, it shows how the Palestinian itself is actually not independent in dealing with their own issues. And another point is about Area C. I think the main problem among Area C is the presence of the Israeli settlements in these areas. And in nearly in all over Area C, I think we know that there are specific rules and specific regulations imposed by Israel that prevent free access of both individuals and Palestinian vehicles. And from the health perspective, that means that ambulances are not allowed in. So for evacuation of wounded people, for instance, or for patients mainly in urgent conditions. So for us, for me, and I assume for the other speakers, it is very easy for us to reach hospitals or to call an ambulance. But this thing is almost luxury for Palestinians. This is why it's so, maybe I can't find the words with how to express it. But in order to add to in order to reach hospitals via ambulances, Palestinians need to suffer a stupid policy of back-to-back ambulance. I mean, they need to reach a certain checkpoint, and from a certain checkpoint, they need to go on a Palestinian ambulance, and then once and the Palestinians need to reach with the ambulance to the main checkpoint, and then he need to be moved to move from one ambulance to the another ambulance, to the Israeli ambulance. So it becomes a mission that is, of course, from the medical perspective, it can damage its condition, and I think this is something that we should all be aware of, how very basic element in our life is something that is almost doesn't exist in among Palestinians. It is in short what I wanted to speak about.
That was Israeli Ron Yaron of Physicians for Human Rights, and that's our show for today. As usual, all views expressed are those of the hosts and guests and not KZSU or Stanford University. If you have any comments about this show, you can email me at susan@raisingsandradio.org and tune in again next week. Meanwhile, enjoy the rest of your week.
Keep a moving, Dan. Don't you listen to him, Dan. He's the devil, not a man. And he spreads the burning sand with water. Dan, can you see that big green tree where the water's running free? And it's waiting there for me and